passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently. By using more sustainable practices. By developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. And we've got a slightly different show for you today. Still largely the same premise. Teddy and Joe talk about college baseball issues, and we have an interview guest. But instead of it being a player or a coach, we have Matt Brown, who runs Extra Points, which is a newsletter, and he also runs a podcast, and he dives into kind of the business of college sports over there, a lot of off the field issues. And this summer has been a transformational one around college athletics. And so we wanted to kind of dive into that here, and Matt Brown is going to help us do that. Run through some of the issues of the summer, like the name, image, and the likeness authorization, I guess, of rights for athletes to profit off of their own likeness in things like sponsorships, the broader kind of realignment situation that was brought about by Texas and Oklahoma leaving the Big 12 for the SEC. And, you know, some of the overall NCAA structure stuff that is now being debated ahead of a planned constitutional convention later this fall, in which the NCAA could dramatically reshape the way it's structured, or it might not. You know, they're just going to, they've got a lot to work through on that. So a lot happening off the field in college sports. So, you know, before we really crank up with our fall coverage over at Baseball America and here on the podcast, we're definitely going to hit the ground running on that in September. We're going to kind of put a bow on this summer of upheaval around college athletics, and Matt Brown is going to help us do that today. So we're excited to have this edition of the Baseball America College Podcast presented by Rapsodo, as it is every week. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national database. All right, Joe, you kind of brought Matt Brown into like my orbit more than a year ago, I guess around the time that he founded the newsletter Extra Points. He previously wrote for SB Nation, covering kind of similar things, and then he went out on his own. And you can subscribe to the newsletter. You can check him out on Twitter. So I would encourage you to do those things. I am subscribed. Joe may or may not be subscribed. I don't know. But anyway, the point is, Joe, that you brought Matt Brown kind of into my attention sphere in college sports, and now it was your idea to bring him on the podcast. So Why don't you give kind of I kind of ran through this already, but why did you think that this was a guest that we should bring on the podcast?
I am a subscriber as well to the newsletter. It's a good one, in my opinion. Good podcast, Going for Two, the name of the podcast. So check that out. Whenever you go to find our podcast, while you're there, look for his, him and Brian Fisher.
There are only two podcasts.
That's right.
This one and that one.
That's right. Yeah. Don't look any further. Like if you've heard their other podcast, that's not true. So I don't know what else to tell you. So, so find both of ours. But you're right. I mean, he kind of right around the time, actually a lot of it was just, you're, pandemic had just hit and there was a lot of uncertainty about college athletics, which we get into in the discussion we have with him, and me trying to make sense of some of it and try to get a feel for what was coming down the pike. And so I was aware of his work. I'd read his book. I've read his college football book he wrote, called What If, where it deals with a lot of like what if scenarios in college football history. So like I'm very aware of his work, but I became particularly interested when the pandemic hit, because we were all pretty uncertain about what was going to happen in college athletics. And he's continued to be an interesting resource from a college baseball perspective, because while he doesn't necessarily talk a lot about college baseball explicitly, the kind of stuff he's covering has a lot of effect on college baseball. I mean, people who are willing to talk about and do it well, by the way, I don't mean this pejorative way, people who are willing to talk about the Texas-Oklahoma ramifications are a dime a dozen, right? There's a lot of people who can do that in a really smart, informed way. But he's able to also really give you the rundown of, here's what's happening in the WAC realignment. And in college baseball, like, yes, the Texas-Oklahoma realignment to the SEC, that really does matter. That matters a lot. But when we talk about the whole of college baseball, the stuff that's really happening below the surface, you could argue is actually more important to college baseball, because the reality of the situation is that while, yes, it does help the SEC in baseball to get Texas and Oklahoma, even if it didn't, they still would have made that move, right? If Texas and Oklahoma were the two worst baseball programs in the Big 12, if they were as good as they are at football historically, they'd still be making that move. So much of this stuff happens outside of college baseball and without a lot of thought towards college baseball. Beyond that, though, there are a lot of little things that are happening that do have a lot of effect. So it's low major conference realignment. It's NIL. We talk about that with him a little bit, and you introed that a little bit there in NIL, beyond just the most famous players you can think of, and the Bryce Young at Alabama with a supposedly close to $1 million deal for NIL, like that kind of stuff set aside, there are a lot of opportunities for people beyond those sports. We talk about some of the stuff that, the possibility of a football league breaking off, and becoming its own thing, the SEC with some other like-minded universities, football programs making their own thing. Well, how does that affect the smaller sports? How does conference realignment affect smaller sports? And he was covering those kinds of things on a really detailed level that way I just wasn't getting in a lot of other places. So that kind of drew me to his work. And so we get into some of that stuff here. We take some big picture topics that a lot of people are talking about, and we really kind of try to drill down a little bit to, okay, but what does it mean for baseball and softball? And some, he injects softball into it a little bit, I think, which is the right way to think about it. Because while we don't talk about softball on this podcast necessarily, in a lot of cases, baseball and softball are going to be tied together in a lot of this legislative stuff. So I think it is important to think of it that way. So the reason why I wanted to have him on, just to tie it back together, is that, we could spend some time on the big picture stuff everyone's talking about. And we did talk about the SEC realignment stuff. He's able to give us a lot better idea of what's happening below the surface, which I think is actually the stuff that ends up having more of an impact on college baseball than the big picture stuff that everyone is talking about.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, off field stuff right now that is going to, it just seems like it's having a profound change on college athletics. For a very long time, people in the media talked about, and people in college athletics talked about, why can't a football player get paid to sign an autograph? Or why can't, a swimmer give a swimming lesson? These were things that were outlawed. And for a long time, just felt like they were verboten, that this was the amateurism was the bedrock that college athletics was built on. And anything that cut into that was going to cause a major problem. And then over the last year and a half, 2 years since California passed its law, which allows for college athletes to profit from what's known as their name, image, and likeness, which is, again, just kind of a fancy way of saying the legalese way of saying that you're allowed to engage in sponsorship opportunities. And, you know, the California law specifically says that you can give lessons in your sport, something that the NCAA had previously outlawed. That law was passed, and then other states followed with their own laws, and all of a sudden this July, on July 1st, the NCAA just said, okay, fine. Like, we fought this long enough. It's now fine. And, you know, college sports seems to be doing just fine with this now being legal. And you know, so now there are just so many things changing. And you heard Mark Emmert, president of the NCAA, say at some point this summer that maybe the association needs to do less. You know, maybe we need to stop trying to legislate all the tiny little details and really be here for, you know, some specific things like running tournaments and managing health and safety and, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, again, this is the kind of thing that just felt like it was unthinkable for a long time. Like, why would the president of the NCAA say something like that? But things are changing rapidly. And this summer definitely seems to have been a flashpoint. So I think there's a lot to talk about in this realm, and definitely looking forward to doing so here today with Matt Brown, who you can find on Twitter at Matt Brown EP, and all the links to subscribe, find the newsletter, to subscribe to the newsletter, to find his podcast, probably all easiest to find right there at his Twitter, Matt Brown EP. So yeah, an exciting subjects to dive into if you're into them. And even if you're not, like, if you're the person that's been kind of tuning out the NIL stuff, we do a good job here, I think, at making it much more baseball specific. So we're not really just talking about like how a football player might be able to make a bunch of money in this marketplace now, or how football is driving all of the expansion and realignment details. We're trying to come at this from a baseball perspective. So I think, again, a lot has changed. A lot is changing. And I think there's a lot to be learned from digging into some of this stuff right now. Today on the Baseball America College podcast, we are happy to be joined by Matt Brown, who runs the excellent newsletter, Extra Points, I guess Media Empire there, Extra Points, website, newsletter, podcast, the whole spiel. Matt, we're happy to have you here. There's a lot that's been happening around college athletics off the field, which is what you focus on there. And so we want to dive into some of that here today on the Baseball America College podcast. So thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to do it.
All right. So I guess let's just take this broad strokes here. This summer has been active on the off the field front in college athletics. You have the name, image, and likeness laws taking effect this summer, and the fallout or lack of fallout from that. You had Mark Emmert coming out and saying that the NCAA maybe needed to do less. You have a lot of thoughts about, you know, just in the ether going around about what the NCAA needs to do, and now some activity potentially towards reform. And then, of course, Texas and Oklahoma leaving the Big 12 for the SEC has created a lot of uncertainty in terms of conference alignment. The Big 10 and the Pac-12 and the ACC are doing their alliance thing. And there's some low-level conferences that are also in expansion mode. So there's just a lot that's been going on in terms of off the field stuff. Where do you, broadly speaking, I guess, where is this now headed? Is this headed towards a more professional college sports model, something closer to the status quo, a split of Division I? Just where does all of this lead eventually?
It's a good question, because I think you're right to frame a lot of these events happening on parallel tracks. that are all kind of heading towards a similar conclusion. And there's, I honestly think there's a couple of different directions all of this could go. We could have a world where the Division I membership remains relatively stable, and the NCAA, the scope of what they're responsible for decreases enormously to the point where we're going to conference individual regulations become a much bigger deal. And the NCAA is there to run particular championships and maybe to do a little bit with health and safety. And that's about it. We could also see a world where the NCAA splinters and we end up with several different organizations specific for each sport. There was some momentum even before this summer in Division I to move FBS football out of the purview completely of NCAA. I mean, the NCAA doesn't run it right now, but have college football run by a different entity and everybody else, you know, that entity takes care of enforcement and regulations, and the NCAA just focuses on everything else. I could see a world where we have that, but also for basketball and even potentially for baseball and softball. We have this for emerging sports right now. There's no guarantee that the NCAA has to be the thing that runs the record books and the championships for every single sport, especially since we saw last year that, you know, maybe they're not as good at that as we thought that they were when you put in a couple of wrinkles. I think this fall is going to be pretty pivotal heading into not just this constitutional convention, but to what kind of alternative models for college athletic governance that power brokers want to put forward. And if I was a baseball or a softball coach, or if I was a small conference commissioner, and I am not thrilled with everything that's happened over the last 6 weeks, I think now is the time to grab a microphone. Now is the time to write a white paper and start pushing your vision. And there's still time for your vision to kind of to pass around and shape what things are going to look like over these next couple of months. If people don't do that, then the squeakier, bigger wheels are going to get the grease. And that's generally the biggest athletic programs.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because, you know, baseball is, I think, a sport kind of ripe for that kind of thing. It's a partial scholarship sport. And you have schools on the far end of the spectrum that would love to fund a full roster of scholarships. On the other end of the spectrum, you have schools that aren't even funding the current level of scholarships, which is 11.7 in baseball. So I think you've got that. And, you know, you would know this better than I, so that's why we have you on. But I have to imagine it's one of the more unequal across Division I in terms of the haves and have-nots, not just based on that, but on things like facilities and budgets and things like that. So I'm interested to hear you say that because it has always struck me. And there, I know we just have spitball conversations in the college baseball media about breaking off in that way. So how much appetite do you think there really is for that kind of thing? And I mean, do you see that being something that football probably has to go first on that, but is that, I mean, how real are those conversations that you've heard?
You know, I think they could be very real, and you're right. Baseball would be an Olympic sport that I would point to is where there are not just enormous gaps between haves and have-nots, but also some pretty significant philosophical differences, right? If you're in the SEC, you might look at your baseball and also potentially your softball programs, especially now that Oklahoma's coming into the league, as every bit of a traditional revenue sport as women's basketball or even men's basketball. And you know, you can get thousands of people to come to a game, and you know that your media rights and broadcasting those games are going to be valuable. And if you could, you're right, if you could, you'd give every one of those athletes a scholarship. And then there are others, particularly I think at the low major level, where this is very explicitly a tuition play. It's very explicitly an enrollment driver. And it's if you catch lightning in a bottle and you win 40 games, you make the college, you win your conference, like that's wonderful, but that's not really the point of the program. The point of the program is to recruit another 25 men on campus that are willing to pay some semblance of tuition. One potential way that you could structure this, independent of having baseball run by its own entity, would be to rejigger the way that Division I is structured around Olympic sports and say, okay, so for both baseball and softball or swimming or track or anything, we're going to have a division that's, you know, 80 to 100% funded for scholarships. And we're going to have a division that more closely resembles the system right now, where it's a smaller, much smaller percentage. And then we're going to have a Division III model, where there's no scholarships. It's Patriot, it's Ivy League time, right? And then schools can self-select based on, you know, the number of sports they want to do on different levels. And I've talked to conference commissioners at the, you know, the mid to low major level that have some interest in this, because if you're a resource starved institution, you might look and say, we can't afford to do this for every one of our programs. We still want to be in Division I, but we could potentially fully fund baseball and softball. And so maybe we're going to try to do that at a higher level, like we're an upper level ASUN or Conference USA program. And then for everything else, we're going to do a Division III model. And as long as we're Title IX compliant, that might still provide a good experience for our athletes and our program. You can't really do that right now under the current governance model. But these are some of the questions that are going to be brought up in the Constitutional Convention. Like, you know, I have a thing up on my newsletter right now where I've been asking people to submit their own ideas for what they want college NCAA 3.0 to look like. And the two bits of feedback that I've gotten the most from fans, from administrators, and even from athletes are, number one, they want the new NCAA's primary focus to be on health, safety, and advocacy of athletes, which is what it was when it was first founded, back when people were killing each other on football fields and Teddy Roosevelt was ready to ban the whole thing. The other thing that they want is they want reforms of what we're calling the governance model, because trying to just squeeze 350 schools into one system where they could not be more different in their goals and their resources and what they're trying to do. There's a lot of appetite for that to change. And I think there's, for baseball and softball in particular, there's a number of different ways where it could lead to much better outcomes for fans and athletes. It's just going to depend on somebody championing it. And like, this is what kind of made me interested in college baseball to begin with, you know, last summer, I think you saw more. And before that, you saw more coaches being willing to take public advocacy positions about, here's some structural changes we need to do to make this, to grow the sport. And I would hope that energy continues to create the governance model that coaches and athletic directors and athletes want for these sports.
Broadly again here, a year ago, college sports was in a kind of a dismal summer, not just in light of uncertainty about the fall, but there were sports getting cut at schools from the Ivy League to, you know, Stanford to Furman to Chicago State, pretty much every level of college sports was going through some level of cuts. And then in the last year, we've gotten to the point where the football, the basketball, the baseball coaching markets were as hot as they'd ever been. People were paying buyouts left and right. And, you know, this summer has been seemingly all about the money. Is it just a matter of the market not, you know, bouncing back from the initial crash of March that led to this happening? Or how did college sports avoid some of the more doomsday scenarios of last summer to go to a point where it seems like it's back to a booming business?
I'm not sure I'm ready to say it's back to a booming business yet. There's still some pretty significant financial headwinds, but you're right. You know, I think last time we were talking, you know, last summer, and I talked to several academics and even people in athletic departments about this, there was a concern, particularly at the Division III level, that a lot of schools were going to close. It wasn't a matter of saving a baseball team or saving a soccer team. It was a matter for smaller tuition dependent institutions of saving the university. And there's even a small number of Division I schools that are really not on great financial footing right now, structurally. One of the reasons that the apocalypse didn't happen was because of the federal government. The CARES Act and HERF sent a ton of money to higher education. And so a decent amount of that money ended up in athletic departments, particularly to do things like pay for testing, pay for increased medical supplies, and to help kind of tide over the initial financial deficit caused by the pandemic. You're able to use this to replace lost revenues. Nobody's using that money to like build a new softball stadium. But that provided a stopgap that made things a little bit more possible. We also didn't see enrollment plummet as much as I think it was projected to, especially among state flagship universities or some larger institutions. Where it really hurt was at the community college and JUCO level, which is, you know, not generally what we're talking about here. So those two things together, and the fact that, hey, now we have vaccines and people generally are feeling a little bit more bullish about going to events, albeit sometimes with some level of restriction, that all helped. But that doesn't change the fact that higher education and athletic department finance broadly wasn't really in a great place before the pandemic, especially for schools outside of like your top eight conferences. If you are a Midwestern or Northeastern or Pacific Northwest regional institution, you still have a bunch of really big problems. If you are like the third or fourth tier regional school in your state, there's a good chance you have some big problems that you're going to need to resolve. You just were given a little bit more time to do it.
We'd be remiss if we didn't talk more explicitly about NIL with you. I would venture to guess, I don't just say this to blow smoke, but I mean, you're probably as kind of engrossed in this stuff as anybody else who's covering it. Not only is it your bread and butter, but also you yourself have played in the marketplace, you know, with your company. You know, you wrote written extensively about some of the more catchy things that have come along, such as the situation with BYU having their football walk-ons be supported in this way. Just generally speaking, what have you learned about NIL so far? How has it played out to the extent that you thought it would? And what are some things that maybe have stood out to you in terms of things you might not have anticipated?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a very broad question. And I think what I would say right now is I still think the NIL marketplace now is going to look very different from the one in 6 months. And it's going to look very different from the one 6 months from now. Two and a half months into this, there's still a lot of uncertainty. For one, a lot of athletes have not even begun to participate in this. I actually just got off the phone with an individual that runs a major NIL marketplace who's expecting the number of athletes that they have on their service to quadruple over the next couple of weeks as athletes get back to campus, begin their seasons, and have more meetings specifically about how to participate. And there's still a lot of price uncertainty, not just with athletes not sure how to price themselves, but for brands too. Because when you think about the kind of companies that I think are most equipped to take advantage of working with an athlete, most of them are hyper-local. They're restaurants, they're bars, they're retail establishments within a specific market, fireworks places, those kind of outlets. A lot of them have never run influencer marketing before. They're not in the business of calculating CPM. They're not in the business of buying Facebook ads. And some of these marketplaces can be a little bit less intuitive. And working with agents is less intuitive. And a lot of the agents don't even know what the rules are yet because they vary so much from state to state. So that's all a long way of saying that I think the amount of money that an athlete's going to be able to get for a social deal and who's going to be looking for social deals is going to change a lot. And there was a big incentive to get in on this in July, because if you signed a deal early, you would get earned media, which would increase the value of your spend, right? I think, could be wrong, but I think I was the first brand to do a deal with a Purdue football player. And that means that like I got like three or four different Purdue websites to write about my deal. And it was with like a backup offensive lineman. He's a great kid. And it was, $100, $150 wasn't a huge deal, but that increased the reach of my campaign. If I did that same deal now, I wouldn't get any of that, because now there's 30 different Purdue athlete deals. And that's going to change the calculus, I think, of some of these brands wanting to get involved.
When you were looking into the BYU deal, and so I guess the BYU football deal is that a local company paid tuition for the BYU walk-ons. And that is of definite interest to any partial scholarship sport out there, because well, a walk-on in football is one thing, but if you look at baseball, most people are not on full money. Yep. Very few people are on full money. So if somebody wanted to step up and do that, the thinking, or maybe fear, depending on where you are, is that that would have a real impact on a partial scholarship sport. And you kind of, your takeaway from that seemed to be that this probably isn't repeatable around the country in football, because most programs don't care that much about their walk-ons. They just aren't that visible, but that a partial scholarship sport might be able to take advantage of that. Can you kind of expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, with BYU specifically, this is a program that I've gotten to know pretty well. It's where my wife went to school. It's where I'm relatively well-sourced. BYU might have the cheapest tuition. Certainly of any FBS school, they're going to be in the conversation for the cheapest tuition of anybody in Division I. If you're an LDS athlete, a Mormon athlete, that's like $3,000, a little over $3,000, which means that you can then give $1,000 to all 85 scholarship players and pay the tuition of the walk-ons. The school told me almost all of them are LDS. Whole thing's going to set you back about $300,000. Now, like, that's big money to you and I, right? But like, if you're a big enough company, that's not insurmountable. To do that same deal at Ohio State or Clemson is going to cost twice that much money. And at Stanford, it's going to cost four times that much money, right? Eight times that much money. And at those bigger programs, yeah, you're right, the walk-ons aren't going to play. A walk-on might crack Clemson's too deep. once every 4 years, like one guy. At BYU, a place that has all kinds of roster management problems with kids going on these two-year missions, walk-ons are going to play often. They might not start often, but they're going to get snaps at multiple position groups, and that's a fan base. Sustainable, but there's a lot of other sports. Like you're right. If a brand decided to do this for a partial scholarship sport, and their goal was to give that team a competitive advantage, I think it would be significant. Like, you know, I'm not super entrenched in the college baseball community, but even I know enough that if you mention Vanderbilt, SEC fans are going to get all mad online because of this idea that their endowment and their academic scholarship situation allows them to kind of quote unquote oversign baseball players and pay tuition for more athletes because they can get them on academic deals. I know, you know, in Texas and Nevada and Georgia, there are similar state scholarship programs. I've had coaches tell me, yeah, if I'm trying to fill out my swim roster and I could find someone that has a 3.6 GPA and they're not quite as good, I'm still going to take them because they're free, because they're going to be on the academic side that's going to take care of them. So if you could find a brand to do that for baseball, I think it would be a big time recruiting advantage. And if you did that over 2 or 3 years, even for a kind of middling or average baseball program, I think you could see some significant, on the field advantages relatively quickly. I mean, maybe not in a place like the SEC, but I'm trying to think, if like you're in the MAC and you've got one school that's going to pay tuition for everybody on their roster over 3 years, I like that team's chances of winning a conference title, given that not everybody else in that league is going to be fully funded.
One of the I'm not sure how to quite put it, but one of the big news items we've had in college baseball the last couple of years has been the plan put forth last year by Michigan coach Eric Backage and a number of others for a new college baseball scheduling model. It's no secret to anyone who follows the sport that one of the big challenges the sport has is that it starts in the winter, essentially. And that's not great for a lot of the country, even in quote unquote warm weather places. What was your reaction to that? And what did you kind of hear as you kind of talked through that idea a little bit? I know you did a little bit of digging on it with people around college athletics, because it strikes me that when it was first put forward, it was greeted with a round of applause from everyone in our circle in college baseball. But because, you know, some people can be myopic sometimes by just looking at what's immediately in front of them. It seemed like there was maybe some steam lost, and certainly the pandemic and lost season, all that stuff played into it. But it seems like maybe as they started to dig under the hood a little bit, maybe some of that enthusiasm has waned a little bit. And now, you know, I couldn't even exactly tell you where they are in terms of trying to get this stuff moving forward. So I'm curious what your reaction was there and what, just what you heard in talking through that.
Sure. So the way this has been described to me is that there are not a ton of athletic directors right now at the Division I level whose primary or even secondary concern right now is about baseball or softball. And that's even true at the couple of places where that athletic director came from the baseball or softball community. And what a couple of them have explained to me is that the best coaches are the ones that are coming in there with these kind of proposals. And I did all the work for you. Like I came in, I'm pushing for this. I want to take the leadership on it. I want to take the slings and arrows. I just need you to back me up, but you don't have, it's not going to take 40 hours of your time. And when that's the case, you know, nine times out of 10, the AD is like, awesome. The initial response that I heard, I think, was very similar to yours. I think I wrote about this on Extra Points. Like, I think it's great. I live in Chicago. I'm from Columbus. I actually started my journalism career writing about some Big Ten baseball. And man, in like late April, it's dismal. It's hard to get people to these games, even if there's some good athletes there, when it's like 41 and cloudy and sleety, and it's just not fun. And you could build a better product, especially in a world where minor league baseball is becoming less prevalent, by making college baseball and college softball a little bit more consumer friendly. My reading right now is like, this is a good idea that people are okay with, but with the pandemic and now with constitutional reform and NIL, and so many of these schools were just so overwhelmed by all of that, they haven't had a chance to think about it. I think if this was a softball podcast or a volleyball podcast or a hockey podcast, and we had other structural questions about what's best for those sports, I think we'd have something similar. The only thing a lot of these folks are thinking about right now was, how do we make sure we don't get sued? How do we handle name, image, and likeness? Where's my school going to be playing? How do I balance my budget? And I'll think about the other steps of that pyramid when those base tournament, which sucks if you're like really passionate about one of those other sports. But I think that's the administrative reality right now.
So I think that kind of dovetails to this. Baseball, you know, I mean, it has some priorities. Some people would say that the revising the schedule is there. Some people would point to the failed effort to get a third full-time assistant coach of a couple of years ago, and others would point to wanted to increase 11.7 scholarships. So if there were a commissioner of college baseball and he hired you as a consultant to say, how do we go about advancing any of these legislative ideas, or just improving the game, how do we make the biggest impact? What's your answer as to like ideas, steps for baseball to get higher up on the priority sheet?
It's a tough question. And I think I would be asking other coaches or other administrators who are passionate about baseball and just think, is it in our best interest to be tied to a world where football is going to be priority 1, 2, and 3 every single time, and then basketball, and then maybe some other things, particularly with anything to do with the conference office or the NCAA? I would study hard the idea of just having a college baseball and college softball association and just say, we're going to create our own definition of amateurism, if that's something that's important to us, and our own standards. And we're going to try to expedite some of this decision-making, because this is a product that's important to us. And if schools want to be a part of it, great, but we can't wait. And there's always going to be another calamity happening with football and basketball. And maybe there are some dedicated reasons why that's not a good idea, but I think I would, you know, I'd try to get the 40-page white paper about that and study it. Because if it turns out then you have to stay in here, then that becomes a question where I'm not sure of the best answer right now. Because broadly speaking, I think when these coaches say we need to start our season in warmer weather, we should have the option to be able to have more coaches to provide a better coaching experience for our athletes and more scholarship money, because that money does exist. And it's not fair to put this financial burden on athletes. I think those are both great ideas. I think any major conference that opposes those ideas is not living up to the ideals that they like to talk about in press releases. You have the money, you should be spending it on athletes. But if it's getting caught up in a bureaucratic quagmire, then I think you have to change the bureaucracy.
We talked about at least a little bit tangentially about the big realignment news with Texas and Oklahoma. But I think for sickos like me, I think one of the more interesting things is what's happening at the kind of from a bottom up standpoint in conferences like the WAC and Southland, the A-Sun, to a lesser degree, the OVC. And a lot of what's driving this is FCS football. But it strikes me as those seem like kind of, especially in the WAC, just some really weird marriages we have in that conference. And it reminds me a little bit of, there's, you know, kind of some consternation about the idea that, you know, Texas Tech has to go to Morgantown to play midweek basketball games. Now we're going to be asking maybe Abilene Christian to go play a baseball series at Sacramento State. So what is the reaction among people who aren't involved on the football side in these conferences to now having these really kind of strange mixes of programs in these leagues?
It's interesting because it isn't just FCS football that's driven some of these realignment decisions, but the conversations that I've been hearing over the last year, and this was true before the pandemic, and I think it's more true now, is that it's not just about FCS football. That's part of it. With the WAC, honestly, basketball is just as big of a driving force here as football. I've talked to ADs and people in that conference office who think our goal is to be a multi-bid basketball conference. And we think that we can get to that point eventually, especially given the size of some of these schools. I haven't heard baseball come up once, but I've heard basketball just as much as I've heard football. And there's some optimism within the new A-Sun, which, you know, some of that expansion is driven by football. But like, we think we could be very competitive in other sports here as well. But the driving force beyond those two things has been geography and institutional fit, in part to help with some of that Olympic sports travel considerations. You know, I think there's a lot of commissioners and a lot of coaches that look over the last decade and think, because of football, we've already had some very weird conference alignments. The American Athletic, as a group of like-minded institutions, makes no sense. There's almost no like unifying institutional identity between any of those schools, right? There's private, highly selective research-focused schools. There's regional public schools. There's urban schools. There's ECU. they're in the North, they're in the South, they're in Wichita. Like there's the only unifying thing is we care about football, and that tends to lean towards instability. It's not a great experience for Olympic sports. So, you know, when I look at the WAC and I look at the ASUN and maybe some changes happening in the Southland, even though some of those look weird geographically, they are born out of trying to be with schools that are more similar. What the ASUN's trying to do on their new football side is we want to create a confederation here of larger Southern state universities. And that's what Kennesaw is, and North Alabama, Jacksonville State. Like they have some similarities. And with the WAC, even though they're not there yet, like we want to be larger regional state universities and private schools within the Southwest. And that's what most of those schools are now. There's, I guess, a couple outliers, and we'll see what happens with those. And we'll see what happens with some of these other leagues, because I can tell you, most FCS conferences and most leagues right now that don't sponsor football but are Division I, they're having these similar calls.
Well, so we've covered a lot of ground here, but let's really get down to brass tacks and ask a difficult question. So, Matt, we're gonna ask you about your favorite sandwich here in a second. I will filibuster for a moment to kind of give you a chance to gather your thoughts on this important topic that affects us all. But we ask every guest for their favorite sandwich, and we leave it broad. You can give us a sandwich that you make at home. You can give us a sandwich you enjoy from someplace locally. We have had people give hot dogs as an answer, just to give you an idea of how open we are about how you define a sandwich. So please, Matt Brown, describe to us your favorite sandwich.
And, you know, I live in Chicago, which I think is a great food town. It's a great sandwich town, because when the weather is so garbage for 7 months out of the year, you need some food that's going to stick to your ribs so you can hibernate. But when I think honestly of like the best ones, it's when I used to live in New Orleans, and the best po' boys I ever had there wasn't anything in the quarter. They're generally in the back of liquor stores where there's like a deli. There used to be one nearby the school that I taught. Just lettuce, tomato, mayo, and some fried shrimp on that delicious po' boy bun and roll. And, I've never been able to find any place that sells po' boys outside of Louisiana that gets the bread right. And sometimes the filling's right, and you can get good jambalaya and good gumbo and other places. And, you know, Louisiana natives go all over the country and start restaurants. But I haven't had the bread that's the same anywhere outside of South Louisiana. And I miss it. And hopefully I can go back maybe when the weather's garbage here again and enjoy New Orleans, because it's been a little while since I've been back.
It reminds me of probably the best piece of sandwich advice I've ever received. And actually, it's one of those things. I don't remember if somebody actually gave me this advice, or I maybe heard it on a podcast. It feels like something like maybe Dan Rubenstein said on the Solid Verbal one time, that like the way you can really elevate your sandwich experience is invest in good bread. You know, because it really elevates an average sandwich to an above average sandwich and a good sandwich to a great sandwich. And I don't know that, frankly, truer words have ever been spoken.
Dan is somebody whose sandwich advice I would take as the gold standard.
That's right.
And if you're ever in Chicago and you're buddies with him, you have to try his pizza. Like Dan is a great reporter, and he's a great radio personality, and he's a great human being to be around. He is an otherworldly chef.
We should all be so fortunate to have as much pizza in our lives as he has in his, no doubt.
Yeah, but yeah, between him and Mike Felder, like this is the best place to be for college sports reporter people / pizza nerds. It's a little bit hard for me to lose some weight.
Well, you know, going into football season, probably not the time for that. Time to bulk up for the winter anyway. So
that's I'm telling my wife y'all said that.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time today to go over some of this big picture stuff. Definitely interesting times afoot in college athletics, and especially this fall going into that constitutional convention in a couple months. So Matt, we really appreciate you joining the Baseball America College podcast today.
No, it's my pleasure. Friends, I can't guarantee that I'm going to write about college baseball every week or anything, but if you're interested in this kind of off the field sort of issues, I think you probably enjoy Extra Points, which you can find at extrapointsmb.com.
It is an excellent newsletter. We enjoy it here. So definitely check that out. If you've made it this far in the episode, you'll probably enjoy it. Thank you again to Matt Brown for joining us today on the Baseball America College Podcast. Joe, we could dive into this at a number of different points, I suppose, but here's what I found to be most interesting. Well, I shouldn't say most interesting. Here's what I kind of gravitated to the most. The idea that in a potential new NCAA power structure, that things might be much more sports specific. This was something that Mark Emmert actually mentioned in that same interview where he talked about the NCAA doing less, that they would be more open to, you know, sports specific rules rather than making there be rules for across all sports, be more open to individual sport governance. And, you know, Matt Brown said that he felt like maybe that's the best way forward for baseball to advance its interests is to find a way to separate either by itself or with softball in a stick and ball alliance to bring their own governance structure within the NCAA. Nobody really has any idea what that might look like yet. That's a process that just is going to have to play out as the NCAA goes through its constitutional process. But that is a very interesting idea that, you know, baseball could find a way to provide more of its own governance, and that might free up some of the bureaucratic backlog that it has fought for many years now in terms of adding scholarships, adding coaching spots, season start time, recruiting calendar, all the rest of it that it has to push through NCAA bureaucracy if it could find a way to separate itself from some of that.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's what I gravitated toward. I mean, there was a reason why we kind of followed up on it and stuck there with it for a little while longer, because that was something I had not anticipated him saying, you know, frankly, something that wasn't even really on my radar. But it makes a lot of sense. And I think we get little windows into what that might look like here and there, right? So, like, I guess the example I would give, and we only have these narrow examples, but, you know, you look at NCAA hockey, for one, and, you know, I don't know how many college hockey fans we have listening, probably a few, but you look at Division I hockey, and it looks pretty different from what Division I anything else looks like, I would say.
Well, there is no Division I, right? It's all just, they're all in it together.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I guess I should see that. I mean, that kind of, I guess, illustrates my point by saying that incorrectly. Like, college hockey looks so much different than really anything else. And sure, okay, geography plays a role, I get it. Like, there are some challenges that were not man-made, let's say. Like, it just so happened to be, well, if we're all going to do this, like, this is the way it kind of has to be because of the way these schools are aligned. So I get it. But it is very, very different than really anything else that we have out there. I think you can even use some baseball examples, right? I mean, like, Dallas Baptist does not play Division I sports in anything but baseball, and nope, it is just fine. Like, the world has not ended. But I mean, I think that would also solve, like, so on that point, I think it would also solve some of the conference issues we have, right? Where conferences are searching for members and, you know, baseball is not really driving the bus on this, obviously. You know, in some cases it's football, in some cases it's basketball, depending on what, you know, what school we're talking about, but those are the sports driving it. But how freeing would it be for, you know, just taking a league off the top of my head because they've had members cycling in and out, the Summit League, it would probably be pretty freeing if they were able to say, well, okay, what if we took this school that plays baseball in Division II and is really, really successful, and we could have them play baseball in our league, but they don't have to play other sports in our league. They could stay at Division II in some leagues, or they could go play in whatever, you know, whatever conference works best for them in basketball. And
or the flip side of that, you know, Western Illinois or somebody could say, like, well, we're interested in playing Division I basketball, but we're not interested in doing this other stuff.
Yeah. And so I've always been kind of on a very base level, using the Dallas Baptist example, I've always kind of wondered why that was allowed. And by the way, it went so well. Like, there's no one complaining about that arrangement. Maybe the other teams in the Missouri Valley Conference kind of, you know, but I think they would even realize how good that's been for the league. So the Valley is happy with that arrangement. DBU is happy with that arrangement. So there's not a lot of downside there. Like, you have to be choosy about it in that case. I get it. You can't just, you know, you'd have to be very intentional with this, but that very narrow example has gone so well that the idea that it seems like we've not really thought that, hey, how is this scalable and reproducible? It seems like the thought has never really gone there. It's always been like, well, yeah, that's a one-off. And it's like, okay, does it have to be, you know? So again, that's just one very narrow example of the ways in which I think this would free that up. But it's the one that came to mind because it is the way in which, you know, college baseball does have this little cutout for a very specific situation that I think would be great if we could just dispense with the idea that it has to be anything but that moving forward.
Well, the one thing I would say though, is that if that were to come to pass, and obviously there are people that would be interested in a baseball only governance structure, that would seem to accelerate a split of the Division I baseball teams. Because if the whole idea of having a specific baseball governance structure would be to push through things like scholarship increases, you have a whole bunch of Division I teams that are not at 11.7 that probably wouldn't go along with that. So that is a huge negative of it. If you are concerned about a potential Division I split, which is something I'm not a huge fan of, because I like the fact that they all play together. But obviously there would be advantages to it. So, I mean, that's one thing that kind of, I guess, caught our fancy there. The other intriguing thing, of course, is the NIL stuff. And, you know, we'll just have to wait and see where some of this goes on the baseball front. We haven't seen a whole lot of deals yet. That doesn't mean that things aren't working behind the scenes. I have a feeling somebody before long is going to make a big move. But like Matt said, they're just, with this all being so new to potential sponsors, advertisers, whoever, the players themselves, agents working through it, the schools, the states, everyone involved, that it just, because, you know, it takes a little bit longer to do some of that stuff. But now that all the players are back at school, probably a little easier to organize some things. And I'm going to be very interested to see where that goes this fall from a baseball perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting. So like, that jogged my memory about something that I found interesting in the conversation, which was the point that he made about, you know, the students are just now getting back to campus. And I hadn't really considered that if the NIL marketplace seems a little slow to the outsider, and like, I don't know whether to judge if it's been slow or not, because, you know, we've never done this before, but it has felt like, you know, there were some really splashy stuff right off the bat, and then it kind of settled a little bit. But that is a good point, that there are probably a lot of athletes that are like, well, I kind of feel a little bit out on my own on this, and I don't want to do something that's going to get me in trouble, because, you know, let's be honest, even if they've made it very clear that you can do this, in their shoes, I can see how I'd be like, well, but I don't just want to take a stab at something because I don't want to get in trouble for something and all that stuff. So the fact that kids are getting back on campus, I think is big for moving that forward.
And well, I also think the collective action, you almost need them there. So if you're going to see something like what BYU did, like, you kind of need all of the walk-ons in place to talk through that or whatever.
Yeah. And that's I think this ties together with what we were just talking about a minute ago, where you talk about a potential Division I split off in baseball, which I too am not for. I like that there is one division and we have the opportunity for, you know, Coastal is a bad example because they are a have versus a have not in baseball, but, you know, Kent State getting to Omaha, that kind of thing. Stony Brook getting to Omaha. Like, I like the idea that happens, even though it's the exception instead of the rule. I like all that. I also, just from a logistics standpoint, like, if the top cut off a Division I is 40 teams, do we just pull the CWS from those 40 teams? Or even if it's 100, do we just pull 64 teams from the 100? Like, anyway, that's obviously something that we should that ever come to pass, we'll talk about that. But those are the questions that I have. But, you know, this is a way in which, with the NIL, kind of using what BYU football did as a model, this is a way in which, hey, if you're someone who's involved with a program, and I know of examples in college baseball where there is a very motivated baseball booster core that sometimes gets frustrated that they can't more directly contribute to baseball, because the money gets funneled to like kind of more general athletics thing or, you know, whatever else. They want to support baseball, full stop. And so for those types of programs that have guys like that, I think there is an opportunity there for you to really make a difference. Obviously there's the stuff where you can put up money for a specific player to have them, you know, work, do some advertising or whatever it is for you. But I do think using the BYU model in a partial scholarship sport, as Matt pointed out, I think it's a real opportunity. If you consider yourself if you want to be a have instead of a have not, and you're in a conference that maybe you're looking to elevate from, not in a literal sense, but just in terms of doing what Coastal did, for example, in the Big South, you know, maybe there's an opportunity there. I think that's a really fascinating idea that I hadn't really considered from a baseball standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, previously, you know, just a couple of years ago, we saw, you know, an anonymous booster drop all that money to Binghamton for a stadium. And that was kind of the way you had to do it before. But now, I mean, and I do think that is going to have a transformative effect for Binghamton to have like an SEC caliber stadium in the America East. But, you know, you can provide that a little more directly if that's the route you want to go down. And, you know, I think anything that happens in the SEC is probably just going to be repeated and, you know, around the conference, and it's going to be hard to really gain a significant advantage that way. But, you know, he mentioned, you know, obviously the Vanderbilt situation, but also he mentioned the academic aid that Texas, Georgia, Florida, several states are able to provide. If you're in a state that doesn't have that, well, I mean, you know, that's long been a disadvantage for the schools in Mississippi and Alabama. Well, this could be a way to go about making up some of that ground.
I've actually been told that Vanderbilt's the only school that has extra aid they use for baseball. That's what I've been told.
That's what they say on Twitter. That's for sure.
Twitter and message boards have led me to believe that Vanderbilt is the only school that has extra aid sitting around.
But the Hope Scholarship is it's a real deal, and it's a really good deal for the Georgia schools, as is Sunshine in Florida, and I don't know what they call it in Texas. Joe, do you know what they call it?
I don't actually, but I'm aware of it. I don't know what it's.
Yeah. So all of that is quite interesting. Joe, did we get anything else out of Matt that surprised you or tripped your trigger?
Yeah, I just think the idea that, because I think this ties into, we talked about the new college baseball model, and I think we were right. It feels like we all kind of came to the same conclusion that, because you and I have talked about it offline, the reason I asked the question was kind of for the answer he gave, which is just like, these schools have a lot of stuff going on. Like, shifting the college baseball calendar is not, frankly, a priority. Probably would not be a huge priority in great times, much less still dealing with the fallout of a pandemic year and how they're going to recoup what they lost, et cetera, et cetera. So building off that, though, the idea that, you know, if baseball is going to grow, it's probably going to have to come from stuff like the new college baseball model. And it was disappointing. And by that, I mean, I guess I should back up before I just leave that. By that, he mentioned doing the work, showing the value, presenting it to administrators and saying, look, here, it's done. Read it at your leisure. Let me know what you think. But here it is. And then them being able to just kind of, you know, I don't want to say rubber stamp it, but basically say like, no, and here's why, or yes, let's pursue this without the administrator having to do that legwork. And while I wish college baseball was not in a place where that was going to have to be the case, I thought he spelled it out just right, though, that as much as maybe we're disappointed that the momentum behind the new college baseball model didn't necessarily just like go straight to the moon to where now we're actually talking about implementation, I do think the genius of that, now that we've had some distance on it, the genius of it was the way in which they rolled it out, to where it was like, you know, here's all this information. It's been exhaustively researched and discussed. We've beaten this thing to death. Now go talk about it with your administrators. I think that was a little bit of genius, and we still don't know what's going to become of that or any other of the legislative stuff that college baseball wants to do, but it is very clear that we are still, as a sport, very much in the place where the legwork is going to probably have to be done on the front end by the people who don't really have the power to enact it.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. You can't ask Ray Tanner and John Cohen and totally blanking on the few other ADs with significant baseball background. You can't ask them to do the whole thing. They got other things that they have to do. They aren't just the commissioner of college baseball, at least not yet. And so you do have to meet people where they are. And that means that people that are more invested in college baseball than, you know, the average athletic administrator probably need to be the ones presenting the arguments and the plans to advance whatever proposals you've got. And that, you know, I've said this before, but the way that the arguments that are going to work for administrators are plans that either save them money or make them more money, or just are clear benefits to student athletes.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, that was the beauty of the model I put forth last year, is in theory, at least, it kind of touches on all those things. So we'll just kind of have to see where that goes from here. I mean, right now it's nowhere is the answer, and that's just going to have to be the reality. The last thing too, we talked a little bit about the small conference realignment, and in a perfect world, I think we would have, at least I would have, let me just speak for myself, would have dug in like a little more there.
I mean, Joe wants a full episode on WAC realignment and where Sam Houston fits into it all.
So bad. I want it. Like, I'm itching, like I'm full sicko mode on that, but jokes aside, like, because I think there are motivations for all of those moves that are slightly different. I kind of just, for the sake of a jumping off point, said that FCS football is driving a lot of this. And I think that's true enough. But I thought it was interesting that he talked about the motivations for the WAC being as much basketball. And he admitted, you know, I haven't heard baseball yet, but it does show the motivations are a little bit different there. And so I think I would have liked to have dug in a little more on some of those individual ones. That's one of the things I failed to mention up top when we were kind of introducing him, is one thing I can guarantee you is that he's talked to people in all of these leagues, you know, like he's really beating the bushes on talking to administrators and people of interest in all of these conferences to try to get to the bottom of it. So you and I have talked about, we're going to have to do an episode in the preseason next year that literally is just us reading off the teams that are in each conference, because it's going to be needed. And those conferences in particular, WAC, Southland, ASUN, those are the big ones. And I'll be interested to see, you know, the example I use of Abilene Christian flying to play games at Sacramento State, like, not just from the, sure, that's going to cost money, but also just like, my goodness, those are tough trips. And, I think you could see a situation where, you know, that, I don't want to say untenable, because nothing is untenable, but just ends up being a little bit of a grind for those teams. And maybe they'll have to figure out something a little bit unique in terms of scheduling and what have you.
Well, I know from reading Matt that, you know, they've talked about in the WAC about how they feel like this new WAC can be a consistent two-bid NCAA basketball league. And that's significant for them because of the way the NCAA distributes basketball money, that being two bids means more money, and being two bids gives you more of a chance to win a game or two, and that means even more money. So, like, that's why the focus on basketball, but I also think that the new WAC could be a pretty strong baseball league. And now the way that baseball tournament revenue is distributed is not the same, so they're just not going to see it in the same way. But, you know, I mean, we've already seen Sacramento State, Grand Canyon, New Mexico State, at least under Brian Green, those teams really have something good going. Cal Baptist is not yet postseason eligible, but it has looked very good. And now you're bringing in these Texas schools, including Sam Houston State, which has a super regional within the last few years. So I like that league from a baseball standpoint. It's not being crafted for baseball, but it is something that is potentially pretty exciting from a baseball perspective.
Totally agree. And it can kind of insulate the WAC from some of the issues. You know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the show about the West Coast being so insular that sometimes it can make things tough for conferences. And this does insulate the WAC from some of that. It prevents some of it from the WAC standpoint, because you are going to get, to use a word that our friend Mike Rooney likes to hear on the podcast, this is for you, Runes, cross-pollination with...
Is that one word or two?
I guess it's technically two words. No, I guess it's two. So cross-pollinate, it's a phrase, I guess, more than a word. But yeah, I don't think it'd be hyphenated. But they, you know, you are going to get the schedule cross-pollination where some of the teams, the Texas teams, are going to get the benefit of the fact that the WAC plays the Pac-12. So Grand Canyon's going to play the Arizona schools, and Cal Baptist is going to play the schools in Southern California, and so on and so forth. And the Texas schools are going to play, you know, some of the teams in the SEC, or, you know, potentially the SEC and the Big 12 and, you know, whatever's left of the Big 12 and what have you. They're going to play Dallas Baptist, and all that's going to be pretty helpful. And it's going to give some more variety to the WAC in their non-conference stuff, so that if the Pac-12 is not very good and the Big West is not very good, it makes it kind of hard for the WAC to really build much there in terms of an at-large profile. And it might still be hard in this new iteration of the WAC, but I think being able to have a bunch of different cracks at folding in high RPI stuff into schedules, even if you know, Cal Baptist won't play Texas, but if somebody else plays Texas and wins a game off of them, that gets folded into Cal Baptist, and that all helps. And so I'm with you. I mean, it's going to have to work hard. All these low major leagues have to work hard to get a second team in, but I certainly think this new iteration, it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, we talked last week about the idea of like what conference could like pop up and have a Conference USA-esque year, and the WAC is not going to suddenly have four teams in the tournament at some point. But you mentioned the A-Sun, and the WAC can do that. I don't see why it couldn't do that. It's going to be one of these kind of overly large conferences, and it'll have a distinct bottom, and they're never going to be able to bring the whole bottom up to the top of the league. But, you know, that they should be able to, you know, put two bids in at some point. And that's just something that hasn't been possible for the WAC for many years, at least not since in this current construction of the WAC. But I like its long-term future. And as long as they're able to hold together, you know, what they have now, obviously there's no reason to think that, you know, they won't, but it is just going to be an interesting arrangement that may take a little bit of finagling to get the best arrangement for a conference that is now going to, as you said, regularly have to send schools from Texas to California, to Seattle, to wherever else the new WAC has schools.
In some ways, it's kind of a throwback to, you know, the WAC that I grew up with was... You know,
did you grow up on the WAC?
I did not. I more grew up on Conference USA. I'm gonna be honest with you. I more grew up on Conference USA, but the WAC, I do recall the WAC that included, you know, Louisiana Tech and Rice, and they were making annual trips to Hawaii, you know, to say nothing of the California schools. I guess in some ways, Hawaii might be easier to get to in some cases, because you're probably just going to LA and then, you know, where you need to get in Hawaii, as opposed to getting on a bus and driving somewhere once you land. But so this is kind of a return to form for the WAC in some ways. This is what they were born into in a lot of ways. And so I think from a baseball standpoint, it's a positive. Like if we were going to go through and talk about how realignment has affected each of these conferences, I think you'd have to see the WAC as much more positive than any of the others, really, I think, because they have added not just numbers, and boy, have they added numbers, but they've also added some quality there too. And I think that's going to be seen when it's all said and done.
Absolutely. So we were, I'm happy we did this. I'm happy we dove into these off the field issues. They do affect a lot around college athletics and college baseball specifically. So glad we were able to dive into them here on the Baseball America College podcast. We're going to be back to a little bit normal here, as we get into September, bringing on guests from around college baseball once a week. So make sure you're subscribed to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts. You can follow Joe and me on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. And again, if you're looking for Matt Brown, our great guest today, He is Matt Brown, EP. All right. So till next week, thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Rapsodo for presenting this and every edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Joe. He's Teddy. I'm Teddy. He's Joe. We'll talk to
you next time. We're leaving that in.
We'll talk to you next time on the Baseball America College Podcast.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.